Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. I am so excited you are here today with us. Today's show is following up on our fantastic lecture that we just had on suicide and substance abuse. And today's topic is going to be on substance abuse. Really fascinating talk with some great guests today. But you are listening to KRUU FM 100.1 on your FM dial and on the internet everywhere. We're broadcast Tuesdays at 6:30, rebroadcast Thursdays at 12:30, and we're on the internet where you could seek us out. Our website will be up soon, but we're also going to be putting these broadcasts on the Mental Health Alliance meetings, and we encourage everyone to contribute to the discussion and growth of mental health issues in a community and in this country and in the world. How's that? Today's topic is about substance abuse. This is Dr. Scott Terry, and I am a marriage and family therapist, counselor, educational psychologist. I run the Fairfield Mental Health Alliance with a whole bunch of other people trying to make a difference. I also run the Arden Counseling Center, the Arden Community Wellness Center, Restarting Relationships, and a couple other things I won't even go into. I'm a busy boy. And if anybody has any interest or anything else, please contact us at mentalhealthmatters@kruufm.com, or you could email me directly, scott@ardencenter.com. Ardent is A-R-D-E-N-T, so scott@ardencenter.com. Anyways, enough about this. This is Scott Terry and...
Ann Lindy Berg. I am a new mental health counselor with Arden Center working with Scott. Hi.
Hi, and you're joining the show today.
I am.
All right.
Hi, Scott. My name is Lisa Woodfour. I'm a certified substance abuse counselor with First Resources. We do have an office here in Fairfield, Iowa, and we also have substance abuse counseling in Ottumwa, Iowa.
Great. Great. And you're going to tell us this Midwest perspective and how it's applicable everywhere, no matter where you're at, how it is, and how this notion that you guys approach substance abuse really has impact everywhere, a different way of thinking about things. Something like that.
Yes, we look at substance abuse as a holistic and a family issue. If we look at the country, we're looking at how substance abuse impacts one out of two people. Either they know somebody, they have someone in their family, or it's impacted them.
Absolutely.
So it's an important conversation to have. I'm Kathy Pringle, and I'm the director of First Resources Corporation Treatment Counseling Services, and I also do the Children and Families Program. So through both those programs, I obviously am in contact with people who suffer from substance abuse issues, and I see the effects it has on the children and the whole family. I think often when we think of substance abuse, we look at the person that's the addict and the attention goes there. It's a ripple effect, like throwing a rock in a pond, Midwest terminology here, but that ripple effect affects the children and the mothers or the fathers. Or it just impacts the whole family.
And then that ripple effect, it's a great analogy. I love that analogy because that rock in the pond then ripples back on the person. So if we think about, we've been doing a lot of shows on PTSD, for example, yes, talking about trauma. Well, yes, you have somebody who's been traumatized, but then that traumatized person, let's say it's a veteran coming back from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, that person might be traumatized, but then they might inadvertently traumatize his family around him, his family, and then those family members then affect, almost like a disease, those around them, and then it comes back to that family and back to that person. You really have to think of things systemically. Things are flowing. It's not just people live in isolation.
I agree, and to carry that a step further with the ripple, it also impacts community, employers,
absolutely,
hospitals, mm-hmm, and the whole community.
Absolutely.
So that's why it's so important that the community look at the problem of substance abuse. So many people, too, one of my most frustrating things is working in substance abuse is people look at this like if they just wanted to, they could get over it, or if they really loved me, they would stop. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's such a simplified way to look at such a complex problem.
Now, Kathy, are you speaking of the feelings that the addict themselves have, or the family members as well? Do you feel like everybody can share in these thoughts that somehow they feel aren't helping them to move forward?
And I think it's both, Anne. Mm-hmm. I think that the loved ones, the children, there's a lot of theory out there about how children who grew up in alcoholic homes are impacted, and mm-hmm. different roles that children that grow up in alcoholic homes are impacted.
Certainly. A lot of work on that.
So I think the answer to that is both. And it's just a cycle that the families get in, and sometimes it's like the forest through the trees. They don't even recognize they're doing it. And the loved one of the addict thinks the problem's all the addict's problem.
Sounds like the first thing is that this is a natural feeling. If you're having a feeling about yourself or about your loved ones, that why can't they just snap out of it? Do we have to live this way? That your first message is that's natural.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're not alone.
Right.
But we've come a long way with substance abuse, but there has been so much stigma mm-hmm. regarding substance abuse. If you look back in the 1900s, what did they do with people with substance abuse? They locked them in the house, they hid them, they put them in sanitariums. It was just the 20th century, you know, the word alcoholic blame. And some treatment came out.
Sure.
And treatment centers, you know, became real popular in the 1970s, but it was still a secret that we were doing this. And so it's becoming more mainstream, but I think as a world we need to embrace it and say it's not a personal defect, it's not a moral issue, this is a community health issue.
And there's ways to allow ourselves to get past this. If we get over our guilt, our shame, our remorse, and our judgment of others, but mostly of ourselves that we project onto the others, you know, that moral weakness of somebody else. Why can't they pull themselves up by the bootstraps? Anybody ever try and pull themselves up by their bootstraps? It doesn't work very well.
I bet.
You know, it's like we all need to come back to a pragmatic thing. What do we do? And it really is such a choice. It's not that there's a right answer, which makes it a little confusing, but it also really is about an opportunity. So everything can really be an opportunity for growth.
Yes.
Everything. I talk a lot about application, and something good, like I tell every client that they should exercise and meditate and change the diet and change their sleep patterns and do things to start taking back control of their lives. But everything could be good or bad depending on what you do with it. So exercise is a great tool. We all would agree it's great. But it could also be terrible if you're doing it in a way that's inappropriate. You could also have something that's terrible, such as getting lost in an addiction of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And once you say, you know, it's time to take back control, it's time to shift and to take advantage of this dark road that I've gone down, or my friend or family member or loved one has gone down, it's a great opportunity to say, now life can really happen. And a real opening, the real possibility is there. And so we don't get stuck in, here's a problem, let's fix it. But we get look at this larger opportunity of what we can create from this.
And that's wonderful. And I agree. And I would like every addict trying to get, or alcoholic trying to get better, to recognize that. But first we have to help them with the shame and guilt. It's a progression to get better. And they come in with so much delusion and shame and guilt to protect that addiction.
Mm. Such a solid point. Shame and guilt is debilitating, and it will completely affect your ability to conceptualize a problem and
yes.
to go after a solution. You just get stuck there.
Yes. And then at the same time, the family member that's just support can become as sick in a different way and maybe sick's the wrong word.
No, no, no. But I think it's people get lost in their codependency. So explain what codependency means.
Codependency is when you look at other people's well-being and their life and you become obsessed and absorbed with them and trying to control them and you lose the insight to take care of yourself. So, you know, often people who love an alcoholic will try to be a better lover or try to be a better provider or try to do things to change the behavior of the alcoholic and addict. And it's always to no avail because, as Lisa said, there's a whole physical and physiological change that's going on in the addicted person. So then the partner thinks they don't love me. I'm not enough. So then they start in their own codependent role.
Kathy, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is this codependent behavior, is it always a conscious thing? Or can it sometimes happen unconsciously?
Oh, I think it happens unconsciously.
Oh.
You know, I do. People just try to do what they need to do in their life to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when addiction and alcoholism is full blown in the house, they're trying to survive that because they love the person. I think that's something that would be a great conversation, separating the addict from the person. And that's hard to do when someone is...
But we do that with our children. Our children do something bad. We don't say they're bad children. We say that they had a bad behavior, right?
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the codependent kind of thing, we think about it, again, from that systemic perspective. That's the world I come from, is a systemic world. And the way to think of it is, if I focus on changing me, then my partner has to change in reflection of me. I become the reference point for myself. He becomes the reference point for himself.
Yes.
And so as I change, he has to change in response to me getting healthy and strong and not buying into the game anymore.
And that's interesting you say that. I completely agree. But what happens is we look at addict as a problem, not the family.
Yes.
And so the alcoholic goes to treatment, they get sober, you know, whether it's through a social organization, church, 12 steps, whatever avenue they find. And then the other family member hasn't gotten any help.
Yeah.
Right. So the roles in that family have changed, and it's a system that has learned how to operate with an active alcoholic or addict.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Places a lot of pressure on the recovering addict who comes back and then sees that they're really being tracked to behave a certain way. It probably brings the cravings back and makes it all the more difficult.
It is. It takes courage. It takes personal motivation. You know, Jungian theory says that you have to get outside of yourself, and that's completely opposite of what alcoholics are. They're self-absorbed, you know. They are self-absorbed in their addiction. It's not that they're bad. They're just feeding their physical and psychological.
Well, they have a different focus. They do.
They do. And so then you get them sober, and they don't know. They don't know how to live a lot of times, and everything's changed, and there's requirements for them to stay sober, develop sober support, wherever they can find that. And many times the family member feels left out, mm-hmm. and alone. We've had people say, I understood it better when they were active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought that was such an honest answer I got from a wife once. She knew those rules.
Right.
You know, so it's
or how to join in and become a drunk with them or whatever it is. But and when they feel threatened, they will often want the other person to go back to drinking or whatever
yes.
it is. But the problem isn't stopping drinking.
No.
So when we're going to have two parts, hopefully today, and we're going to talk about in our second part about not just stopping the drinking or the addictive behavior, but stopping needing to be an addict, stopping to need to run away, getting a much bigger perspective. So the whole game falls apart. There's much more we could do. But I want to tell everybody, just take a break. We're on KRUU FM 100.1 on AirFM Dell. And today we're having a fascinating discussion among four of us regarding addiction in its many faceted forms.
Yes.
And one of the things I want to get to, you're going to talk about some of the signs and symptoms that people should look for individually within themselves and within a loved one.
When you're looking at the symptoms of addiction, many times that you can confuse addiction with mental health issues, but one of the primary signs of addiction is the feeling of being out of control. That means that when you start to either take in the substance, whether it's alcohol or whether it's an illicit drug, then the person can start to crave more of that drug or alcohol. And so it becomes a repetitive
Lisa, behavior. It sounds like you're describing a cycle here.
Yeah, it's a repetitive cycle, and it's behavior that the person has a hard time stopping on their own. And that's because that the chemistry in the brain is actually changing. And the chemistry in the brain is expecting that substance or that alcohol to be there. And the person can start feeling withdrawal symptoms. They can start feeling anxiety, depression. And to help them cope with those withdrawal symptoms, they have an urge to use more of the alcohol, or they have an urge to use more of the illicit drug to relieve the withdrawal symptoms. And so that's why we call it a disease of the brain, because mm-hmm. because of the chemical changes in the brain.
Of course. Very, very challenging.
So,
and to dovetail off what Lisa said, not only illicit drugs, we have seen a trend here, and I don't know, and I've heard and read research from the rest of the country that prescription medication has become rampant.
Well, not only is that a huge thing, and it's actually an epidemic right now.
Yes.
So the heroin trade has skyrocketed. And part of that really comes back to prescription meds for painkillers.
Yes.
And people are so afraid, and we could talk about the symptomology behind pain, but people get so afraid of their pain. And, I mean, there's nothing. I did a documentary. I used to do documentaries. And I did one on the elderly that was fascinating. And what was fascinating to me about people at that later stages of life was not that they were afraid of dying. People were afraid of being in pain.
Yes.
And we all get lost in that. We could all, every one of us, being human, get stuck in that notion of pain. And sometimes we try and self-medicate through alcohol or drugs, okay. Or sometimes we're seeing a doctor, and our doctor says, here, take this pill. And so then we take the pill and we feel better. But then we get trapped in needing that pill. That's the addictive cycle. And then at some point the doctor says, oh, whoa, you've been taking it for a while. It's time for you to get it off. And I was, well, what do I do? How do I get off? I'm an addict now. You've got me. My doctor has become, what is it, my dealer or something. Yep. And so then the doctor cuts them off because, whoa, this person's a little bit lost and needing too much of the pain pills. And the nervous system has gotten so used to needing that pain pill that it doesn't know how to adapt otherwise. And so then they start going to illicit drugs. And
You know what? And I'm wondering, too, is everything Scott is saying really touches some nerves as far as clients and individuals in the community. But there must be some people who are listening who are wondering what kind of indicators might show them that they need to seek out some help for themselves or for a loved one. Some concrete examples that just might light up someone's attention and say, ooh, wow, I didn't know that was the case. Lisa?
I think that in many cases, there is some indication that there's a problem with the alcohol or the drug use. And so the person will get defensive. If someone confronts them about their drinking or their drug use, then a family member or a friend may confront them about it, and they become defensive, and then that escalates into an argument. So lots of times, you know, there is that discord in the family where, you know, they're trying to get the person to see that there's a problem, that the person is trying to defend and cover up that their use. And Kathy talked about shame and guilt. Well, because that person may have acted inappropriately. Say you're at a party and then you've had too many drinks and you acted inappropriately. You come home, you talk about it, and the person is unhappy with how you behaved. Also, another indicator might be that the person is, they might be lying about where they went. Mm. They may be hiding alcohol in the house. They may be taking things from the home and selling them to buy their drug of choice.
So it sounds like you're referring to defensiveness and dishonesty are two kind of red flags that could happen at any level. They could be kind of low level, or they can get really high up there to criminal behavior.
Absolutely. And, you know, these are the kinds of behaviors that are that self-destructive kind of behavior in chemical and substance abuse, because it does escalate,
sure,
because of the chronic nature of the disease, because it's repetitive, and the person seeking to get that, you know, euphoric feeling that they got in the beginning, well, now it's escalated from, you know, I was only snorting it, and I was getting by on a little bit of amount of it, and now I need more of it, and I'm not able to work because I'm depending on a drug,
mm-hmm,
and the only way to get it now is to start some illegal behavior.
Oh, how awful. How difficult.
It is, and the very nature of the addiction is progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So the very nature of the addiction is progressive. So what started out as a couple drinks at a party then becomes more, the tolerance increases, and so then inappropriate behavior starts.
Right, the pleasure is not accompanying it the way it did at first.
Absolutely.
And you're perhaps taking the substance for the pleasure, but the pleasure's not being seen. You're seeing more behaviors that are destructive and real difficult, challenging for everyone.
Absolutely. I'd like to comment on what Scott said, though, about the prescription medication. I completely agree. But many times people take prescription medications and it's not for physical pain because they have that shame
absolutely.
And guilt. So
yes.
It's really emotional pain that
yes.
they're hiding from.
Excellent point.
So I want to make sure the audience knows that it's just not physical. It's emotional. There could have been childhood trauma, divorce, grief. I mean, life. Life
yes.
happens. And they've formed an unhealthy behavior to something to hide that pain.
Sure. Well, the line between physical and emotional pain, research is showing us, is becoming increasingly blurred, that the painkillers do dampen emotional response, which gives us an indication that emotional pain has a physical element. So you're absolutely right. Someone who has experienced a lot of trauma and had some difficulty processing that may be somewhat more susceptible to addiction. Which is certainly worth considering as a possible factor when you're considering if a loved one may be at risk or even yourself.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to return back to the notion of systemic. And what's an interesting thing that we do to ourselves, so this is an internal example of an internal systemic, is that guilt, that shame, that remorse, that judgment that we have of ourselves. So I tell clients this little story of, let's say I weighed 600 pounds and I had a really tough day because I'm not healthy and I'm not taking care of myself and I can't breathe and people tease me. I come home after a long, hard day, and what's on the table is a chocolate cake, my favorite dessert. oh my God, and I struggle with myself, I'm not going to do it, and who would do such a mean thing to me to bring a chocolate cake to my house, except I live alone and nobody visits me. Okay, so I have this chocolate cake there. All right, so what do? I taste a little bit after lots of struggle, and then the next thing I do is I beat myself up. That's the guilt. That's the shame. How stupid, how bad. I'm overweight. I don't feel good about myself. And what did I just do? I beat myself up. Oh my God, why would I do something like this? And then the next thing that we do is then we eat another piece. Then we actually start eating it. And then we beat ourselves up. And then we start eating more. And then we start. And then at some point, the first piece is good. Second piece is okay. Third piece gets a little sickly. And now I don't even hate, I don't even like this cake. And I can't stop. And I need it because I need to feed the emotional pain to stuff it down. And I don't even know why I'm running away anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember how this game got started with needing the alcohol or the abuse or the whatever started this guilt. I'm in a trap and I need to let go. There's a bigger picture to let go to find a way out.
It's a vicious cycle.
It's a vicious cycle. And so the way to start is like when you're in a hole, what's the one thing we stop doing? Digging, right? Stop making it worse. Get that things aren't working. Let's be honest with ourselves and go, got it. Things aren't working. Let's make it better now.
Absolutely. And I think we need to look at guilt. Guilt says to me that I've made a mistake. I've done something wrong. Shame says there's something inherently wrong with me internally. Mm. And so what? Everyone, addicts, families need to know there's nothing wrong with you. You know, addiction isn't who you are. Mm-hmm. It's part of who you are. Addiction isn't your family. It's part of your family.
Mm. And it's a behavior. It's not your identity. It doesn't exactly have to be your badge of honor or shame or your scarlet letter. It's just, okay, got it. This, you got trapped. Doesn't matter how you got trapped. It doesn't matter why you got trapped. Exactly. The point is it time to get out? And we're almost out of time, and I want to hear one last round from everybody, and then hopefully we'll do another show right now. But this has been a fascinating discussion. So let's go back around the room.
Well, this is Ann Lindyberg again, and I just want to say how grateful I am that Kathy and Lisa are here to talk with me about the services available in Fairfield and talk with all of us. And I'm looking forward to talking about some of the interventions that you have to help individuals in this situation. And we've
again,
got lots more to say.
If you have an addiction problem or need support, you could contact First Resources, you could contact Arden Center, you could contact Optime. There are resources here locally, but there are resources around the country and around the world.
Thanks, Scott. I just wanted to mention, this is Lisa Whitford again with First Resources, and we do have a office here in Fairfield. It's located on 2200 West Jefferson Street. And our number there is 641-472-4106. And we would love to be able to meet with you, talk with you, help you with any substance abuse problem that you might have. Our job is to be supportive and empower you to change your life and to get well.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be on the panel with the three of you. And if someone or a family member is out there suffering from substance abuse, know you're not alone and there is a solution and that you're a good person.
Yeah, and there's a way out.
Yes.
And you are good. And it's not about bad or good even. It's about life. It's time for life to be good.
Absolutely. It's a great way to put it, Scott.
Well, thank you, everyone. This is a great talk. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.